to everyone for coming along tonight. As Andrew said, he's got more people interested in LIBOR in Sydney than he does in London, apparently. Before I start, as we kick off, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. We've got a pretty decent lineup of people to talk about LIBOR here today, around about as good as you could ask for, I think. And so we very much wanted to put on and have the opportunity for people in the local market participants to talk to the people very much at the cutting edge or on the front line of this, given everyone was actually in town. Just to give you a quick run through as to how we're going to go tonight, I'm going to introduce Andrew in a second, and then Andrew's going to talk for about 10 minutes or so. Then Cathy Armour is going to introduce Chris Giancarlo. Then Chris is going to give talk for a bit and then take some questions, and then he has another engagement, so he's going to take off after that. And then after Chris leaves, then we're going to have a panel discussion that Helen Lofthouse is going to moderate between Andrew, Cathy, and myself on. So there'll be further opportunity for questions then, but Chris is sort of going to be a little block just by himself about halfway through. So let's kick off, and I'd just like to, very, very pleased to introduce Andrew Bailey, who I don't think needs a lot of introduction. So Andrew's had a long career at the Bank of England. He was Deputy Governor for when the PRA was first set up a few years back. And now, obviously, is Chief Executive of the UK, of the FCA in the UK, and has very much been front and centre in the LIBOR discussion over the last few years. And really, I don't think we could ask for anyone better to speak on that topic tonight. And so, without further ado, I'd very much like to welcome Andrew both to talk to you tonight, also to Australia. It's the first time he's actually been out to this part, neck of the woods. So welcome, Andrew.
Well, thank you, Guy. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great pleasure to see that LIBOR is so popular in Australia. And I feel slightly guilty. I hope you're not concerned, therefore, that we're trying to end it. It's also a great pleasure to be in Australia. As Guy said, it's my first visit, actually our first visit, because my wife's here as well today. And I can only conclude one thing, that we've waited too long to come here. It's been an absolutely fantastic visit. So I think we'll come back quite soon. But thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And Guy and I have discussed LIBOR in many places, but not in Australia. So it's a great chance to do that for the first time. So I was going to set the scene to start with and talk a little bit about where we are, how we got here, and what we're doing, and what the issues are as we see them. So let me just start with a little bit of history on LIBOR. The origin of LIBOR in many ways, and it sort of goes back to the start of my career, certainly in the Bank of England in the mid-1980s, is that if you go back in time, we had a separation of financial markets in global markets between what I might call domestic markets, which had official institutions such as obviously the Reserve Bank of Australia and the Bank of England supporting them, and obviously governments supporting them through central banks, and the euro markets based in London, hence LIBOR, London Interbank Rate, which didn't have those same institutions operating in the same way. And it was always, it's always more interesting to look back on these things and question them than perhaps was done at the time so much. As to why we had this sort of, this separation of markets. And LIBOR was, in a way, the nearest thing you had to an official rate in the euro markets. But, of course, it wasn't, therefore, risk-free, because it didn't have that sort of institutional backing behind it. If I'm sure many of you will have dealt with the TED spread, the Treasury Eurodollar spread, or other spreads like that over the years. And, of course, that was the representation, if you like, of the spread between the risk-free rate and LIBOR was a representation of interbank risk and interbank lending rates. And really from that, I think the use of LIBOR spread more probably out of convenience than possibly thought at the time. And it spread into two really distinct areas. One was cash and loan markets, and the other was derivatives. I think there's a strong case, certainly for derivatives, that much of that use was as a proxy risk-free rate. It wasn't seeking to, in a sense, proxy bank risk, but that's effectively what it had in it. But you can argue, of course, and there would be substance in arguing, that in the cash loan market, there was, of course, naturally a measure of bank credit risk to reflect funding costs, and that those were obviously time-varying. So there were two, in a sense, clear uses of LIBOR. There were obviously crossovers because there was hedging going on. But as we, in a sense, know today, and I'll come back to in terms of talking about the issues that we're dealing with, those two uses are, in many ways, different in nature. Now, meanwhile, I think three things have happened in the intervening period, more than the last decade or more. First of all, that separation of markets that I talked about has gone. We don't now distinguish between domestic markets and the euro markets, and that leaves LIBOR looking more like a legacy. Secondly, we obviously had scandals that we as the regulators in the UK had to deal with, but others had to deal with them as well. What that pointed to was an element of fragility in LIBOR, but I would say from the point of view of those particular scandals, which were reprehensible in themselves, it was solvable fragility. But it did point to a lack of, if you like, a lack of attention being given to an important part of the infrastructure that we have in markets, namely how the pricing was set. Third thing is perhaps the most important for today's agenda, which is that the market that LIBOR is measuring, the interbank market, since the financial crisis, of course, has shrunk to the point when in many areas which LIBOR is purporting to measure, it doesn't actually exist. And that, in many ways, is the most important challenge we have. The LIBOR is now based on very thin markets, and in some cases, there aren't markets there, and the consequence of that is that it's based too much on so-called expert judgment, and that is not to call into question the judgment of those who are making those calls at all, and it's not to, in any sense, suggest there is misconduct going on, but it just is too fragile. And, of course, underneath that, it begs the question, what exactly is LIBOR representative of in a world where the market that it purports to represent has in effect, dried up? And I don't think you can actually, we don't feel that we can actually give, much probability that it will at some point reappear based on where we are today. So that's the backdrop. And in many ways, if I go back just finally on this part of what I was going to say to the underlying issues, this point about ending the separation of markets. In many ways, what I think the ending of LIBOR is doing is repatriating the interest rate setting mechanism to the domestic markets and to domestic authorities and domestic institutions, and that seems naturally where it should be. It should be linked to the official rates that central banks are at the centre of setting. So what next, come on to next, what has happened so far in terms of what we're doing? Well, first of all, let me say from the point of view of the FCA, as the regulator of LIBOR, LIBOR is a benchmark that we regulate. We've made it clear, bearing in mind the fragility that I've set out, that past the end of 2021, we are not going to use powers of compulsion, whether they be formal powers or informal powers. We don't think it's appropriate to continue to use those powers of compulsion to compel the existence of a rate which has that fragility. That, of course, therefore begs the question, so how are you going to deal with that situation? So what I want to come on to now is talk about what we've been doing. So the first thing to say is that over the last year or so, a series of new alternative risk-free benchmarks have both been selected and launched or relaunched in some cases. So in the US for the dollar market, it's SOFR. In the UK, it's SONIA, the overnight rates. The other LIBOR markets have done the same thing. You'll probably observe that the euro area is somewhat further behind in terms of dealing with Euribor. That's not a LIBOR as such, so that's not in this set of things that we're dealing with, but it has many of the same characteristics, and they're dealing with many of the same issues. And again, they've identified the benchmark they want to choose, but it hasn't yet started to trade. Now, I must say, I would view the last 12 months in terms of the alternative benchmarks as a success. Most notably, we've seen growth. I look at the SOFR markets and the SONIA markets. They've shown encouraging signs of growth. I think SONIA has grown the most rapidly, but that's not necessarily surprising because they started from slightly different places. SONIA was in many ways a relaunch, whereas SOFR was a new launch. But to give you the latest figures on SONIA, I mean, over 50% of derivative of interest rate derivatives in sterling are now quoted in SONIA. Last week, that number was up to around about 75%. You know, that's a good start. About $150 billion equivalent of SONIA derivatives are being traded each week. So that is it's a good start. But we have a long way to go. And we have a long way to go quite quickly, obviously, given the deadline we've set. And I think there are two points, therefore, that I want to cover. First of all, there is the question of how we get the markets and markets use the new benchmarks for new contracts. Frankly, we hope they all grow organically, obviously. In all the markets, we've got active participation in terms of market users. We welcome that. I'm very grateful for all the market participants who are participating actively. In all the markets, we've got active market committees working with us as authorities to address the issues that naturally come up in terms of solving the issues in terms of replacing LIBOR. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we are making the progress we need to make on that front. I think, if I'm frank with you, I think we've made more progress so far in terms of addressing the issues in the derivatives markets than we have in the cash markets. The cash markets are more heterogeneous. The use of LIBOR is more heterogeneous. It's more heterogeneous in terms of the number of uses it has, and it's more heterogeneous between countries. So you go to different countries, and it's used for different purposes. So I talk about the UK for a moment. We have a very, very small use of LIBOR in the mortgage market, for instance, but you can go to other countries, Spain, for instance, it's got a substantial use in the mortgage market. So obviously the challenges do differ from country to country in the cash markets. The other important thing that's happened in the last year is that ISDA, whom we work very closely with for the derivatives market, has made, I think, good progress. It's run a consultation on the so-called fallbacks, in other words, what would you use if LIBOR wasn't there? For derivatives in the non-dollar markets, and it's now going to take that consultation on, which has been successful, in my view, in the non-dollar markets, and do the same consultation in the dollar markets, with, I think, reasonable prospects of building on what's been achieved in the non-dollar markets. So, what's to do? First thing I want to highlight is, and this is particularly really for the cash markets, that we have to address the issue of what the appropriate term structure is. And how markets wish to use that term structure. Again, we want, as authorities, we want markets to be actively, frankly, leading and developing those alternatives. There's a number of ways you can do it. We're not being prescriptive about it, frankly. You can obviously do backward rates. You can do forward rates. You can derive them in different ways. We have, frankly, been concerned. We don't think the derivatives markets need to use term structures, particularly forward-looking term structures, which rely on what I might call derivatives on derivatives, and that's not happening, and we're pleased about that. Second thing is, and this I think is probably the most challenging issue going forwards, and it comes back to my two uses, the derivatives and the cash market. We are aware in the cash markets that there's an active debate about how you replicate, if you're using a truly risk-free rate, how you replicate that bank credit risk element that LIBOR seeks to capture. Is it a risk-free rate plus a spread? And if so, how is the spread calculated? Would it be a fixed rate? Would it be a variable rate? Could it be proxied in a number of ways? That is an open debate. What I would say about both of these debates, the term structure and the, if you like, the sort of the proxy for the credit risk or funding risk element, is that I think we need to make very good progress this year on defining and coming up with solutions to these issues. So that we've got time to put things into effect. So in terms of my objectives for this year, those two things are at the top of my list. So let me finish with two other things. First of all, in both the UK and now Australia, we have used what we tend to call the Dear CEO letter to write to banks, I know CAFIS sent them out, and say, please will you tell us how you're going about in terms of governance, in terms of what you're doing, to think through the issues that you face in terms of replacing LIBOR, and please can you, in a sense, explain to us how you're giving LIBOR replacement its due attention. And of course, in doing that, we hope to flush out issues as well, which we'd be very pleased to have. We want to have those issues on the table. It's worked very well for us in the UK. I'm delighted that it's now happening in Australia, which I think is a very good thing, because it gets the issues onto the table and it gets the importance of LIBOR for all of us firmly embedded. So I think that's a very good step forward. Then we get to what I would call the most difficult piece, which is we know that there is a legacy issue. The legacy, of course, is very big if you quote it in nominal terms today. I hope that by virtue of the innovations and developments that we're going to have in markets, the term structure and so on, that number will be pushed down, that we'll have ways of substituting for legacy rates where they're available. Because what we need to do, in my view, is identify what the sort of, if you like, the really difficult legacy is, and get to that, and you know, then we'll have to put our heads together and work out what we do about it. And I say that because I don't want to hide the fact that we know there is a legacy in there that could be challenging to deal with. And the sooner we can obviously do this work to put alternatives in place that will help to deal with parts of the legacy, the better, and the sooner we can identify the difficult legacy, the better, frankly. So let me now just leave one thing. We do not think there is a solution which involves muddling along with LIBOR, because the fragilities, I said at the beginning, we think are too great. We're cautious about alternatives that are being put forward which suggest that it might be possible to do that. You get to the point I made about representativeness, whether the data really are as reliable as they're purported to be. And also, I have to say, because a new rate that isn't risk-free would be unlikely, in our view, to be granted hedge accounting status. So there are important issues there. So let me finish. Actually, the progress is encouraging. We've made a lot of progress over the last year, but the timetable is deliberately aggressive. It's always been deliberately aggressive. So there's a lot still to be done. We recognize that. We're very realistic about that. And we're very, very pleased and keen to work with you as the market in all countries, to solve these issues. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And you've certainly given us some food for thought, particularly about whether we really know what the legacy issues are. Have we identified them all? Let me thank Guy, Ellis Connolly and the rest of the Reserve Bank team for having us here today at this event. We know that the LIBOR transition will have a significant impact on our markets here in Australia. We are a highly globally connected economy, so it's pretty key that we all take steps now to prepare for the transition. Andrew mentioned the Dear CEO letters, which we sent out, unapologetically copying the work of our colleagues in the UK, the Netherlands, and I think Hong Kong, who've done something similar. This is done by ASIC, but with the support of the other members of the Council of Financial Regulators. And we're asking a number of key Australian banks, insurance, asset management and superannuation firms to give us back information on the steps they're taking to prepare for LIBOR transition. We've published our letter. We will be bothering all of you, if we haven't sent you a Dear CEO letter, about your preparedness for the changes. But more importantly, I guess, from what we're doing, is I have the pleasure of welcoming Chairman Giancarlo to give us his perspective on LIBOR transaction or transition. Now, as a chairman of the CFTC and a member of the Official Sector Steering Group, Chris has been a driver of benchmark reform. He's been vocal on the importance of market engagement on benchmark reform, and through the Alternate Reference Rates Committee. We really do have an alphabet soup, don't we, of acronyms in this area. But anyway, Chris has been working with banks, market participants, industry associations and other US financial regulators to identify an alternate reference rate to replace dollar LIBOR and to develop a market strategy to make that transition. So the ARC achieved its first goal in identifying SOFR as an alternate reference rate. And I'm sure we're keen to hear from Chris about how this is going, this work is going, and the US approach to transitioning away from LIBOR. So, Chris, thank you for making the trip here and for rearranging your schedule to speak to us tonight. And if we have time, we might be able to take a few questions, hoping. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Kathy, and thank you, Andrew, and thank you all for this warm welcome, and it's wonderful to be here. It's a pleasure on a number of levels. It's certainly a personal pleasure. It's also, like Andrew, it's my first time here in Sydney, my first time in Australia, and I had a chance yesterday to take a harbor cruise, and today visit an old friend from our younger days in New York who's here with his family and took me up to the northern beaches, and just what a spectacular coastline, what a beautiful country. It's also a professional pleasure to be with you to share some thoughts on LIBOR. But it also is a professional pleasure because I'm actually going to be able to get a certain degree of advantage by being with you today in moving LIBOR along back in the United States. And let me explain why that is. I've been pressing our friends at the Federal Reserve Bank in the States to use their network of regional banks to go out and put a roadshow together to tell American lenders and others why they need to get ready for the LIBOR transition. And I've been encouraging them to go to Minnesota and go to Louisiana and go throughout the country to do it. And now when I can get back, I can say, I went all the way to Australia to advocate for these changes. You guys can get out of Washington and travel around the country and do the same thing. So thank you for giving me that advantage that I can take back with me. So the transition from LIBOR to the new reference rates is really one of the biggest changes underway in financial markets, if not the biggest. Hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives, loans, and bonds, and other transactions will be impacted as market participants switch to the new rates. You know, as Andrew said, it's a fragility. And just to give you an idea of the fragility, in certain LIBOR rates, I think in the 3-month and others, there are less than a dozen transactions a day. In some cases, 2 or 3 transactions a day. The average daily transactions is under $1 billion. And yet the amount of the LIBOR market is enormous. It's sort of like a house teetering on one building block left in its foundation, and the potential harm of that weak foundation is something that we all need to be concerned about. It's not a Wall Street versus Main Street issue, to use American terms. It impacts all segments of the financial system. Surely the banks, but also corporates, municipalities, mutual funds, and pension funds managing our retirement savings, households with education loans, and, of course, mortgages. Now, we've been asking if there's any way to basically avoid this transition by, say, fixing LIBOR. Well, based on the evidence in the form of data collected by our own Federal Reserve, the traditional unsecured term funding market that LIBOR has represented for the past few decades really no longer exists in any meaningful manner, and I gave you those statistics. So it comes down to a trade-off between financial stability and market functioning. If we continue tolerating a less than robust reference rate, a fragile rate, in order just to avoid the short-term pain associated with that transition, then we'll eventually have to deal with the risk to the financial system from hundreds of trillions of dollars referencing this rate that trades in the handful and under $1 billion a day. So as chairman of the CFTC, it was a privilege recently to host an FSB roundtable in Washington where we had industry participants from across the spectrum to discuss this benchmark transition. And there was strong representation from the official sector as well, including from all of the major financial regulatory agencies in the United States, including our Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the Securities and Exchange Commission, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and others. We were united at that meeting in our commitment to provide the regulatory guidance and support to facilitate the transition, and we made that unity clear to our market participants. A few words on the efforts related to our U.S. markets. These transition efforts are being spearheaded by something, as Kathy referred to it, as the ARC, the Alternative Reference Rate Committee. We're working closely with the ARC on a range of issues, and we're also aware that U.S. dollar is a global benchmark, referenced directly by firms around the world. In countries like Australia, there is an active cross-currency market. We want to make sure that market participants here in Australia and in other jurisdictions are tracking the ARC's efforts, that they're able to participate either directly or indirectly by providing feedback to various consultation efforts being led by ISDA for over-the-counter derivatives and by the ARC for various loan and cash products. On the need for a term rate, we keep hearing from some market participants that LIBOR is a term rate, and unless a forward-looking SOFR term rate is available, they will not be able to transition away from LIBOR. We're obviously sympathetic to the impact of the transition, especially on the ability of end users to hedge their risks. But these concerns of market participants have to be balanced with a dose of, shall we say, reality. First, on remarks from Andrew, there is a high likelihood that post-2021 there will be no LIBOR, at least one considered representative under European benchmark regulations. So such firms that wish to continue will find that their ability to transact referencing at least a U.S. dollar LIBOR will be seriously constrained. Counterparties might not be able to trade with those firms, with you, fatally impacting your ability to continue hedging interest rate risk. Second, a robust forward-looking SOFR term rate is conditional on a liquid SOFR derivatives market. If every end user decides to sit on the fence waiting for the term rate to become liquid, then we're going to be waiting for a very long time. Liquidity begets liquidity, as those of us in the markets know. If you want a term rate tomorrow, then you have to transact in the SOFR derivatives markets today. On whether dollar US LIBOR can coexist with SOFR, well, our expectation that is post-2021, US dollar LIBOR will be determined to be unrepresentative. In other words, it will be in a zombie state. To the extent ICE, the benchmark administrator, the IBA, is willing to continue to publishing a LIBOR rate, well, then one such rate will be available. But from a financial stability and market integrity perspective, our expectation is that transactions that account for a substantial portion of risk in global financial markets will have transitioned away from LIBOR to SOFR. For US dollar LIBOR to truly serve as a real alternative to SOFR, the term unsecured money market has to grow between now and 2021, from about $1 billion a day, as I mentioned, to something close to $1 trillion a day. Absent that, there is broad consensus between both private sector and the official sector that the market should be focused on transitioning away from LIBOR to SOFR. Now, in terms of a roadmap between now and the end of 2021, undoubtedly, the year we're in, 2019, is the critical year. Focused on determining triggers and fallback language for derivatives and for a whole slew of cash market products that currently reference LIBOR. 2020 should be when firms seriously transition away from LIBOR, both by moving their current exposures out of LIBOR and ensuring that all new transactions reference SOFR. On the official sector side, there is an active coordination ongoing amongst all of the relevant authorities. Our CFTC staff participates in multiple cross-jurisdictional subgroups looking at specific regulatory, legal, and market structure issues. And there are also regular principal-level discussions at the FSB's official sector steering group. In closing, all signs indicate that post-2021, some of the panel banks will be looking to exit from participating in LIBOR submissions. This will likely render LIBOR to be non-representative. So it's critically important that the market transitions away from LIBOR way ahead of such events. Firms should be looking to amend their existing documents to be able to switch from LIBOR to SOFR and other relevant reference rates. For new issuances, new hedges, new loans, new transactions should reference the new rates. And the sooner we stop new issuances linked to LIBOR, we can reduce the pain of having to deal with a bigger mess at the end of 2021. So with that, I'd be happy to take a few questions before letting you get on with the rest of the program.
Thanks, Chris. Matt from Kanga News. Just one question. I know at the ISDA AGM a couple of weeks ago, there was quite a lot of talk around the sort of how IBORs are embedded in wider society and sort of borrowing, like household borrowing and mortgages. So how challenging would it be in the current environment to sort of inform, for instance, mortgage holders about things like, you know, retrospective rate setting?
Well, communications is really a big part of this. I think that a lot of the focus so far has been at the top of the food chain in terms of the major issuance, the major banks. But as I mentioned in my quip in the beginning, we also in the public sector need to do a better job to use all our resources to get the message out. I think that the major financial institutions understand this, but it does need to be driven down deeper and deeper into the real economy. Certainly in the United States, we haven't done a good enough job of getting the message out beyond the major Wall Street banks to mortgage lenders, some of which are regional, smaller banks, community banks, other lenders. There is a lot more work to be done there, but we're doing the work. We are also, to some degree, relying, though, on all of you to get the message out to customers and to start making the transition. So communication, and you know what, I've asked for your questions. I'd like to ask a question here. What, for your community here in Australia, what are the biggest impediments to the transition? What can we do in the public sector to make your job easier? Because this is a big transition. But I think for all the reasons I said and that Andrew said, we just can't ignore the structural fragility in going forward with LIBOR. We have to make the transition. We have to do it together. So you need to tell us what the impediments are, so if there's anything we can do, we can make that happen. And communication is certainly one of them, and it's one that we're aware of.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah. Just wanted to ask one thing.
Yeah.
How has been the feedback of U.S. banks, and how has been the acceptance of SOFR, or are they still waiting for a better rate to emerge, be it forward-looking or backward-looking?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? And as I mentioned, liquidity begets liquidity. So how do you build that liquidity? The good news is the take-up on SOFR futures has been remarkable. You know, the exchanges measure the take-up of new products. The take-up of SOFR futures has been one of the most successful product launches that's ever happened at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So it's been a remarkable take-up. Yet at the same time, it's still in the beginning stages. We still need to build that up. But I think the buildup of liquidity in that instrument it's part of that chicken and egg. It's one of the vital elements of SOFR taking off as a cash product and to build a term structure. And so we've been very pleased with the early developments. And our exchanges, I think, have been very responsible in working with us on this. And ICE now has a product as well, so we're seeing liquidity developing in two competing products, which is healthy for a market. So I think we're encouraged by that, but there's still a lot of work to do. But it really comes with a lot of new issue. We need firms looking at new issue in SOFR on the state side to as opposed to going forward with more issuance of a LIBOR-based product.
You talked a bit about the term structure, and have you looked at the alternatives that might come out in terms of a term structure, in terms of getting 3-month and 6-month term structure? And do you have any problem with it being a derivative on a derivative, so it being a derivative of SOFR itself?
I guess the short answer is no. We don't have a problem with that. What we do want, though, to develop is simple structures, not complex structures. And so I think we'll have to see how that happens. There's going to be an element to the development of this that is going to be organic, that is going to be how the market evolves. I think as the public sector, we have a principal approach to this. We'd like to see simple structures. We'd like to see take-up. We want to see the movement away. We may have views on how some of those work, but we also, I think, are sanguine enough to understand there's going to be some developments of this that are going to be driven by market demand, and we're not going to control every element of how it evolves. So our primary goal is a movement away from LIBOR, and then how those term structures develop we'll have some input into, but the market is ultimately going to determine what works for the market.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Have a great conference.
Thank you. there are a few spare seats over here if anyone wants to take the opportunity to sit down. My name is Helen Lofthouse from ASX. Thank you for the opportunity to ask more questions. Mm-hmm. And Cathy, Guy, and Andrew, thank you for staying to take part in the panel. I guess the first question is, we've talked a lot about LIBOR, but how much of a problem is this really for Australia? And Guy, perhaps I can pass that over to you to start there.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we'll get a direct answer to that is when we get these answers to Cathy's letters. Okay. But partly to what Chris was saying earlier, though, as best as we can know to date, what we don't have is quite the same problem that the question earlier alluded to, which is a lot of products which reference LIBOR outside the wholesale market. So that isn't a problem that we have. So it's mostly confined to the wholesale market. Mostly it's around issuance. So a lot of our corporates issuing in US dollars are by and large going to reference LIBOR. Our banks, certainly their issuance offshore is almost entirely up until very recently referenced LIBOR. And then the one which is probably, those to some extent are reasonably easy to address, relatively easy to address. The more problematic one probably in the longest legacy one will be the cross-currency swaps. So most, nearly all of them will reference LIBOR today, and some of them have a very long horizon. The final element though is on the asset management side. Australian asset managers have 70% of their money offshore. A decently large chunk of that will be in a product which references LIBOR, and then they hedge a very large chunk of that, and that almost certainly will be using a hedge which references LIBOR. So in those products outside the hedges, though, mostly we're just a user of the product. We're not, so there's some issuance. But by and large, the changes will be done by the person who's issued that product, not by the asset management community here. They'll have to change possibly their systems, and one should never underestimate system changes. But I think the biggest challenge really for us is going to be around, I think probably around the cross-currency swap market in terms of a market which is going to have a long legacy tail.
Yeah. And so, obviously, BBSW is a dominant benchmark that's used here in Australia. So what about the future of BBSW, and how does that compare to LIBOR?
So this is the particular challenge we have in this market, which is, while Andrew is telling, rightly, everyone that LIBOR is about to finish, we go around and say, yes, that's right, but BBSW isn't. And the difference is actually fundamental and directly related to what Andrew and Chris were both saying, is the transactions which underpin the market. So the transactions which underpin BBSW are meaningful in a way which generates proper price discovery and which is direct contrast to LIBOR. The BBSW market is orders of magnitude larger than the LIBOR issuance market. Go figure. So we don't have, confident that BBSW for the foreseeable future will continue to be a robust benchmark. And so, which to some extent makes the transition a little easier, is that we are not saying that people need to transition away from BBSW. You should ask the question as to whether BBSW is the appropriate benchmark for the product you're using, because I think one point before I finish I'd like to highlight is most people wrote LIBOR into their contracts without actually thinking about it. And it was there, so I'll use it. Whether it was the appropriate benchmark or not, by and large, didn't figure into people's calculations. I think that's probably true of BBSW as well. Most issuance here references BBSW, whether it's exactly fit for purpose or not. And so while BBSW is likely to continue for the foreseeable future, that still doesn't mean that it might be sensible to ask the question as to whether it's actually the right reference rate to be using.
Yeah. So although we have a healthy BBSW, there's clearly still a lot of work to do in Australia on LIBOR. So, Cathy, maybe I'll direct to you. Can you give people a sense of where to start with that?
Because as a regulator, we'd be so fabulous at it. But absolutely key. The things we've asked firms to do is to assess their use of LIBOR in key contracts, and obviously a cross-currency swap one is an obvious one, but also to assess their use of LIBOR in, if you like, the plumbing of their businesses. So how much of their internal systems depend on use of LIBOR, and to really try and come to grips with that as well. I am, like Guy, a little bit worried that we might be being complacent because we've got BBSW and we've worked so hard on the methodology for BBSW over the last couple of years that we're sort of maybe losing sight. And also I'm really concerned about whether people are ready to negotiate contracts with appropriate fallbacks to LIBOR and have got that happening sort of every day from now on. And are going back and looking at those longer dated contracts and having the conversations now about putting in the fallbacks in the contracts. I think to me that we know that redocumenting is always a big issue and it takes a lot of time and energy, and I just worry that we underestimate that.
So you're worried really that some people might be taking a bit of a wait and see approach.
Yep.
And so what are the risks of that you'd highlight for people?
You just you will lose control of the situation. I mean, inevitably, as you get closer to a period of time where LIBOR goes out of use,
yeah.
the dynamics of the market change, and you don't want to absolutely have to reopen negotiations more broadly on the commercial aspects of the contract, so much better to deal with sort of something that hopefully is a mechanical issue earlier on than leaving it to the last minute.
Absolutely. Yeah. So clearly something that needs a lot of focus from all of us here at the moment. Andrew, you talked about the Dear CEO letters that you sent in the UK. Can you give us a sense of what the FCA learnt from that process? What were the key messages coming through?
We learned a great deal, actually. I think, first of all, we learned a lot about, obviously, it sort of goes to Cathy's point about the degree of preparedness across each institution. And as Chris was saying, this is not just banks, by the way, obviously, because the LIBOR usage goes well beyond that. So the degree of preparedness for this, how much, frankly, thought and planning was going into it across the institutions. And, you know, let's face it, the answer we got back is it's variable. So that has given us the basis to then follow that up. I think it has raised the whole issue within the sort of consciousness, particularly in the sort of the governance framework within firms, which is what we set out to do. And also, you know, we've learnt a lot from it, because out of that, as Cathy, Guy and Chris were all saying, you know, you start to unearth the issues that need to be tackled. So if I could just sort of build on what Cathy was saying a moment ago, you know, by doing this, you'll get to the bottom of how much banks and other firms are using LIBOR, not only in terms of pricing contracts, but in terms of their internal systems. You'll also get to a point that Chris was referring to the meeting we had in Washington about a month ago. You will also get to the questions of to what extent are there any tax issues in there, and to what extent are there accounting issues in there. I mentioned hedge accounting as, you know, as one example of that. And, you know, unfortunately, the devil's always in the detail with this stuff. So that was the explicit sort of, in a sense, you know, reason for doing it. And so far, we're pleased with the way it's gone in terms of raising the levels of awareness and unearthing issues that need to be addressed.
And I'm curious, did you find in that process that there were some firms that had a sort of, you know, best-in-class kind of approach that you were able to then sort of share and replicate? So is that an approach you were...
Well, I think two things, I think, on that. First of all, I think, you know, we found things that different firms were doing where you can say that's good practice, it would be, you know, sensible for the industry as a whole to, in a sense, you know, see that bit of practice. And that's by no means, you know, unique to one firm. The second thing is, yeah, I'm not going to name names, but, you know, some people were being quite complacent about it. Some weren't. I think, you know, there is a view that in some quarters, not very many now, and it's going down, that, you know, somehow sort of LIBOR will just continue if we sort of, you know, we put our heads down, it will go on. That is declining, and that is why I strongly endorse what Chris was saying about, you know, the sort of outreach, as it were. So it's declining, but we do come across that. Yes, so that was another reason for doing it.
Yeah. And you touched on some of those issues around accounting treatments and tax treatments. What's been done to address those types of issues?
So we've got, Chris mentioned the FSB group, the OSSG, which I co-chair with John Williams, the president of the New York Fed. So we've got work streams within the OSSG addressing tax and accounting issues. But to be honest with you, we need firms to bring them to us. It's not stuff that we will necessarily sort of immediately identify ourselves. So in the spirit, as Chris was saying, of the outreach through the ARC, through the UK Market Committee, our answer is, look, please bring them to us. One of the really interesting and encouraging things about that meeting in Washington, Chris alluded to the fact that the US Treasury was present, and it was very encouraging that we had the US Treasury saying in the US context, look, just please bring us the tax issues, and we'll help you. I don't think help in the sense of giving money away, by the way, but help in the sense of technically, if there are issues that need addressing, let's get them out on the table.
Yeah. And so, Cathy, is the message the same in Australia? If there are those types of issues out there, where should people be bringing them to?
We'd be very happy. Part of the exercise is please bring them to us.
Yeah.
Bring them to APRA or the RBA as well. But as a financial regulatory community, we're very happy to engage with those sorts of issues, to discuss them, and then talk to other parties, whether it's the County Standards Board or the Tax Office, and just get to the bottom of some of those issues. I'm absolutely happy to do what we can there. We may not have all the fabulous answers, but we'll do our best to try and address them.
Right. Yeah. And so the Dear CEO letters that you've just sent out, so I guess they're partly about seeking people's status, but also for surfacing.
Exactly. It's about having the conversations, and we've been very deliberate about ensuring that we've put publicly on our website the broad context of the questions and concerns, because we realise we won't have necessarily identified all the organisations that might have an issue, and we need to make that much more broadly available for people to think about and to come to us.
Right.
Yep.
And I guess it's probably early days for you to have any...
It's really early days because we weren't quite as efficient as the FCA. We only sent out the letters last Thursday, so we'd be very impressed if someone's got such a great project that they're able to answer our letters straight away. But so it is early days.
We'll wait with interest to hear more about that. I wanted to move on to the subject of pre-cessation triggers. I had to practice a bit to even say that.
Yes.
But there's been some discussion about incorporating pre-cessation triggers into the work on contractual fallbacks for LIBOR. So what are these pre-cessation triggers, and why might they be needed?
If I start boring you on the subject of the European Union benchmark regulation, please shut me up. So the benchmark regulation has in it this, and I referred to it earlier, this question that any benchmark needs to be representative. And obviously the FCA, we are the regulatory authority in respect of LIBOR. So we do have to reach a judgment on that question. It hasn't been done before because the benchmark regulation is new. So it's only been in for a couple of years. It's a fairly complicated process. And I'm afraid it's a sort of slightly metaphysical question because, of course, what is LIBOR representative of if, as Chris and I were saying, the market has declined to the point in some areas of non-existence? So I can, at this stage, we are doing a lot of work at the FCA on how to frame the question, frankly, because it's never been done before. And that's important. And my view is we're going to have to be very transparent about this. I mean, markets need to know how we will go about judging that. So I would, it's one of the issues that we need to really nail down in the next sort of, the remainder of this year, actually, as to how we will go about approaching that question. I would imagine there'll be quite a lot of legal judgment around that. As I say, it's never been done before. Now, just to be clear, however, what does that mean? There's a question, as you rightly say, about whether ISDA will incorporate that trigger into that structure. We're in close discussion with them We think it would make sense, frankly, to do that, but that doesn't answer the question of what the trigger actually is and how it works. Now, to be clear, if the trigger is used, it doesn't mean that LIBOR just dies instantly. It would have the effect of preventing new issuance using LIBOR, but it would leave open the question of how to deal with the legacy. Now, come back to something Guy said a few minutes ago. In one sense, of course, you can approach the LIBOR issue and say, well, look, here's the easy way of dealing with it. You stop new issuance and run off the legacy. But the problem, as Guy said, is the legacy is very long. It's decades in some cases for some contracts.
Centuries.
You've got some centuries.
Oh, no, I thought you had a century.
And you know, it is not feasible to think that you could sort of bandage LIBOR up and keep it going for such a substantial period of time in legacy. We just don't think that's feasible. So it comes back to the points I made in my opening remarks about how we deal with this difficult legacy. And if I could very finally make one point, you see, the question you asked about mortgage rates is very interesting there, because as I said in my remarks, some countries have it more than others, and of course you've got very long-term contracts there often. And I think if I could just make one final point there, of course, when it comes to dealing with those sorts of contracts, there is going to have to be a key question about what is, I might call it, a fair substitution. How can you judge that the substitute structure, whatever it might be, is fair for both sides to the contract? That is a very hard question. I don't want to take away from it.
Right. So just on the... Just to sort of be clear on the pre-cessation trigger. So the for example, the FCA would determine perhaps that at a certain point a particular form of LIBOR was no longer representative of the market that it was purporting to represent, and would therefore officially say so, at which point that benchmark would no longer be a kind of authorised EU benchmark, is that?
That's correct, yes. Correct? Yeah. You'd have to go through a process, by the way. It isn't. I know you weren't suggesting, so we don't just sort of wake up one morning and decide that. But there's quite a long process. But that's the case. And by the way, I think we would have to do it contract by LIBOR contract.
Right.
We wouldn't do it across the board because, as Chris said, the depth of LIBOR is very different even today. It's not great in any area, but it's negligible in some areas and a bit more in others.
And then that trigger could cause it to therefore no longer be an approved EU benchmark, hence why it wouldn't be able to be used for new products, but as you say, doesn't address the legacy. So perhaps I'll turn to that legacy question. And talk a bit about the contractual fallbacks. And I know several of you have highlighted the good work that ISDA have been doing focused on the derivatives population. So I think that people are broadly aware of that. So maybe we'll focus in on the cash products. And Guy, do you want to maybe comment on what the path might be for determining fallbacks for cash products and actually achieving that?
Well, I think one reasonable path is to use what ISDA's coming up with. I mean, ISDA is sorting this out for the derivatives market, but arguably that provides you at least a reasonable starting point to how you'd want your fallbacks to work on any cash product. So the solutions they're coming up with in terms of what the fallback is in the derivatives market, I think are reasonably transferable to other markets. So to some extent they're doing the work for you. I think the problem potentially is going to be is the one Andrew referred to, is that on the day that you make this transfer or if you have to negotiate the contract, you don't want to wait till the last minute for exactly the reasons that Kathy said, because on that day it is very clear that one of the parties is going to be worse off and one of the parties is going to be better off, and you're not going to agree. If you agree in principle now, ahead of time, as to what a reasonable fallback is, I think there's a reasonable chance you can come up with a sensible fallback. And so the time to do that is now and not wait till the day where everyone can go through contract by contract and work out whether they're worse off and better off and only agree on the fallback when they're better off and refuse on the when they're worse off, and we're in a, you know, wonderful world of wholesale contract frustration. So so that's why I think it's worth, it's sensible to try and work out what these fallbacks are now in general. And again, from the wholesale market point of view, I actually don't think that's a too challenging an exercise. And by and large, that's the space we've got to deal with here in Australia. Luckily, probably more by accident than by design, we don't have too much retail, if any, actually, retail exposure to worry about here. So is it, I think your issue is going to be when you're dealing with renegotiating mortgage contracts at a retail level. That's not something, by and large, we have to worry about here.
Right. And we've talked about fallbacks for LIBOR and the certainty that LIBOR will be going at some point in the not-too-distant future. What about fallbacks for BBSW?
The same.
Yeah. And he's just done the survey and doing the drafting, so why wouldn't you look to include those fallbacks in your contracts?
Absolutely. So same message, get through the fallbacks.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's LIBOR shows is that in principle, in potentially, these benchmarks can disappear. Mm. And by and large, the fallbacks didn't envisage this happening.
Mm.
Now it's clear this can actually happen. I mean, I don't know if you probably know this, but the fallback mostly for LIBOR was ring one of, and same true for BBSWs, ring one of the submitting banks and ask them what the rate is. Well, they've already just told you that they're not going to tell you what the answer to that question is. That's why the benchmark doesn't exist anymore. So that fallback is not robust, even in the practical sense, let alone the legal sense. So, you know, what this has done is actually highlight this fragility, and that fragility needs to be addressed.
Yeah. And so the message really is that the fallbacks work needs to be done comprehensively.
Absolutely.
Across the board.
So in the rules for BBSW, we do have, you know, at the end of the world sort of forcing outcomes, but I think everyone, including the regulators who would have to impose that, much preferred that there would be a market practice of having adopted fallbacks that, you know, reflect how everybody's comfortable operating in if the benchmark did run into difficulties.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, the other thing, if I could just pretty much point on that, see, I do think that if I look at the UK situation with sterling, the alternative rate, SONIA, is keyed off the Bank of England official rate, effectively. It's the overnight rate. And that makes a whole lot more sense as the sort of the anchor. To Guy's point, I mean, you know, nobody sort of thought about, well, is LIBOR going to go away one day? They sort of assumed it would always be here, and then it got used for all sorts of purposes. I think it is much more sustainable to key it off something that has a link back to the official policy rate that's being set in the currency.
And I think there's and Guy, what are your thoughts on that in Australia? Because obviously BBSW continues, but you can make the same argument, I guess.
Well, we provide a risk-free rate. We, the Reserve Bank, provide a risk-free rate. We publish it every day. It's there to be used. It isn't being used very much at all, but it is there to be used. It is a risk-free rate. Now, a risk-free rate is not fit for every single purpose, but we would be very pleased to see further development around that, more issuance referencing the risk-free rate rather than BBSW, if it's the right rate to use. And I mean, as Chris said earlier, and I think Andrew alluded to earlier, it is a bit of a chicken and egg problem. So, you know, people won't use it because it isn't there, and it isn't there because people won't use it. But there are some initiatives out there to try and get more usage out there, and we would actively encourage you. And once the usage starts, then the hedging starts and the derivative products start. And, you know, and in the UK, I think, is a particularly good example in what the space, basically 12 months, the market has really taken off. We've had two Australian banks issue SONIA linked product over the past 6-9 months. So, you know, it's now a larger market than the credit-based market, I think, in the UK.
Last week, 77% of interest rate trading was in SONIA, in sterling.
Which is just great progress.
It's terrific. I mean, to be honest with you, it was ahead of my expectations.
So I think it's about time for us to take questions from the room, if there are further questions for our panellists.
Good evening. Bozo from the Australian Financial Review. Just a question for Dr. DeBell. Dr. DeBell, do you agree with the market's inference that the RBA will be forced to cut rates?
So while we're talking about one reference rate, I might be talking about that reference rate. really here to talk about this particular issue.
You're not going
to
comment on...
No, not now. I'd really... The opportunity... It's very rare that we have the opportunity to ask someone like Andrew about an issue which is absolutely central to the functioning of financial markets. So I think I'd rather take the opportunity to ask questions on that.
Hi. So this is it's a little bit weak of me not to have done this question to Chris while he was still here, but you know, completely agree that the Sonia evolution has been fast and is working well, and you know, we're very supportive of it. But you know, as an Australian issuer, we do get the opportunity to meet with lots of global investors and also the investment banks. And I think we've been a little troubled by the lack of, you know, I'd certainly say consistency of commitment, but even awareness, particularly with investors in the US around, you know, the evolution of LIBOR. And this point around denial, let's say, is really big. And so when we kind of think about, you know, what is the thing that, you know, certainly Chris can do to help us, you know, help the market, mm-hmm. you know, definitely the investor piece of this is really important. And these are really big organizations, so they're on the ARC committee. So it's sort of interesting that sort of lack of broader acceptance. And you know, we've done extensive polling on this, so I feel fairly confident to say there is quite a lot of inconsistency around the acceptance of, you know, a lot of the points that you've been making, which, you know, we very much support and agree with.
Well, I mean, let me say, I mean, I can't speak, obviously, for the US in that sense, but let me say two things. First of all, of course, it's easy for me to talk about the UK and Sonia, and it's a smaller market. It's a relatively small market. So, you know, we're pleased with the way it's gone, but we realise that we're dealing with a smaller, you know, a smaller challenge. I think the second thing I'd do is just repeat what Chris said. I think, you heard a very strong view from Chris that he, and I know this from many conversations with Chris, that he is very strongly the view, and it's not one that I think others don't hold, that a lot more needs to be done. You know, he talked about, you know, getting out around the country and, you know, explaining what's going on. And I think, you know, I strongly agree with Chris on that. You have to do the hard work to explain it. And I think if probably Chris was still here, he would say that and agree with you on that point.
A question for either Andrew or Guy. We haven't heard anything about secured versus unsecured rates. Mm. So just with the US going down the secured route, do you have any concerns about that difference that might create for cross-currency swaps and so on down the track?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, does it make a difference that, you know, in this process of what I called earlier on, you know, what I might call repatriating interest rate setting, that in doing that, different countries and different authorities have made different choices. And so, as you rightly say, you've got if you take the UK versus the US, an unsecured rate in the UK, you've got a secured rate in the US. And those were very conscious choices. I have to say, based on experience so far, I don't think that's, you know, a critical factor, but I think it's one that, well, I think I can safely predict, I think there will be a lot of academic work done on that. And I think it's something that, you know, yeah, we need to keep a close eye on.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, a bigger challenge versus secured and unsecured, I think, is credit versus risk-free.
Yeah.
So, again, if I think about cross-currency swaps, if if Australian banks are issuing in the US and they're issuing on a SOFR, or issuing in the UK for that matter, and issuing on SONIA and then issuing BBSW back here, then in the cross-currency swap, you've got the credit risk in there as well. Now, you know, market participants have paid a lot of money to sort out these problems, so it's not inconceivable that someone can't actually sort that one out, but that is, I think it's an interesting challenge. I think it's an interesting thing for us to think about here if the market moves to a risk-free based issuance for financials or corporates, for that matter, offshore, what that implies about the future development of the market here. To Andrew's point, I think the difference between secured and unsecured, I'm not so sure that's so first order as the difference between about having credit on one leg and risk-free rates on the other one. I think that's going to be an interesting one, and to some extent, they're probably more interesting in terms of solving the legacy issue rather than the future issuance issue, where I think in the end, I mean, I think the other issue to, area to think about whether you end up with a fixed or floating as well, I think is another thing to think about going forward. But I do think, as I said, I think from our point of view, it's the bigger issue potentially is going to be if you have a risk-free rate on one leg and a credit rate on the other, how's that going to go?
I mean, I think one thing, and I did, you know, sort of pick this up in a lot of conversations with in the US that will, I mean, is attracting obviously a lot of attention, is when you choose a secured rate, you know, if you get spikes in period end to quarter ends in that secured rate, which are a function of the structure of the repo market, then that will, and if you, and that's going to become your benchmark, then, you know, I think that is a point of attention. It is getting a lot of attention, I know, in the US. In terms of the sort of the dynamics of the market and how that's coming about.
I mean, another issue which I think someone, if I don't say this, will probably ask the question is, and it's related to this, is you don't have a long history here of these rates to know how exactly they're going to go, and I think that that creates some concern. That said, when LIBOR started, you didn't have a long history either, and eventually it evolved, but I suppose the market now is so many orders of magnitude larger now than it was then. But I think that is another concern, is if you have different, you know, if the supply of collateral, you know, there's a large supply of collateral out there for a repo rate at the moment in the US. What if you get to a world, which we've experienced here, where that isn't the case? And so how does that go? Not obviously in sight in the US anytime soon, but nevertheless, at least conceivably.
No, I mean, you also got issues around, you know, this quarter-end issue is also around regulatory treatment as to whether you use moving averages to assess things like leverage ratios or you know, or not.
Yeah.
Great. I'm just going to pick up another audience question.
I had a question on the development of term risk-free, forward-looking term risk-free rates, where the message coming from the FCA seems to be more negative than the message coming out of maybe incorrectly.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
The development of a forward-looking term risk-free rate.
Yeah.
The message coming out of the EU and the FCA seems to be a bit more negative on the prospects and, in fact, desirability of developing such a benchmark. I was wondering if you could comment on that and also to the extent that...
I think I said anyway was, look, we are open. I want to have this debate has to happen this year. Chris said the same thing as well. We need to get past this debate. And frankly, you know, when I say we, our market committees and we as authorities need to have this. I certainly started the thing open-minded about this as to how you could structure it and what is required and whether you rely on backward looking and forward looking, and as Chris said then and Guy said, how you develop the forward looking given the chicken and egg issue. So I don't want you to come away thinking that the FCA is negative about that. I mean, frankly, I am in the spirit of let's have a very open debate about this and conclude it, but can we please conclude it, you know, I would say this year, and move ahead. Because we've got to put in place, you know, whatever infrastructure has to continue to develop as a consequence of that, and then we have to, as I was saying, do all we can then to use that to solve the, not only to move the market on in terms of the future issuance, but also to solve the legacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other issue to note is the aim of this is not to replace one fragile benchmark with another fragile benchmark. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that term market, should it develop, and be good if it did, but you want to make sure that it is also sufficiently robust and you haven't got another market which is subject to the same issues that LIBOR was subject to.
Now, I'm conscious of time. Just check if we've got any other burning questions before we wrap up.
There's someone behind.
I had a question for Mr. Bailey. Thank you for joining us here today, sir. Am I right in understanding from your speeches that this concept of unrepresentativeness of LIBOR in the context of the pre-cessation triggers is defined by the number of banks submitting a rate, as your speeches seem to suggest? And my second question related to that is whether Brexit may have an impact, whether you can at all comment on it, if Brexit might have an impact on that pre-cessation legal environment at all, given that it's a BMR regulation, if you will.
So the number of banks submitting is one part of the framework of the test as we see it. As I say, we're going to do the work to set out in more detail how we interpret the test, because it's never been done, as I said earlier. But it's not the only part, because clearly, you could be left, different constituencies of banks would look rather different, and to be frank, I'm trying to be nice about this now, about in terms of the robustness of the thing going forward. So it's not the only, by any means, the only test, but it clearly is one of them. It, by the way, it doesn't specify, there isn't a number in there in the regulation which says, well, when you get down to this number, it's kaput, as it were. It's not that simple. So that's what we've got to interpret. On Brexit, my natural reaction is rather like the first question of Guy's. I haven't come to Australia to get away from Brexit, but never mind. Apologies. Actually, this is one of the simpler questions, one of the really simple questions to answer on Brexit in one sense. And in the UK, what we have done in preparation for Brexit is to use a terrible turn of word into a verb, onshored EU legislation into UK legislation, and that includes the benchmark regulation. So as things stand, if we leave the EU on that basis, we will have a mirror set of EU regulation. We will have the benchmark regulation in UK regulation on day one. And that's what we would therefore put into effect. So in that sense, Brexit's not an issue.
So a short last burning question, if we could. Thank you.
I'm struggling to see for the corporate debt market how we survive in a world without LIBOR. If I can think about the ISDA side of things and their bilateral agreements, it's a relatively sort of standardised way of approaching it and agreeing with counterparties. On the corporate debt side, it's not a bilateral issue. This is, thousands of different bonds with different bond documentation, investors, and to me it seems like an impossibility to put fallback language into all these different bond agreements. How do you foresee that part of the market surviving in a world where LIBOR doesn't exist?
Do you mean going forwards or in terms of the legacy?
Legacy products.
Oh, I say, because going forwards, I think my strong advice would be fallbacks in place.
Yes.
Because to be honest, it sort of goes back to the point Guy made earlier that it was an assumption LIBOR would be around forever. It probably doesn't look great that there's no fallbacks in these contracts, but we recognise there are contracts out there which have exactly the characteristics you describe. Which is why I made the point earlier on, if you don't mind me saying so, that we want to try and narrow this down as far as possible and give as many options as possible for what I might call voluntary conversion in the cash market, so that we can narrow it down to what I call the difficult legacy and then work out how big the difficult legacy is. But my starting presumption is we've got to try and press down on the difficult legacy as much as possible to try and solve it without getting to this, this sort of more difficult scenario first. But you're right to highlight this, and it's exactly why we want this sort of close contact with the market to say, can we please, work out how big this is and what characteristics it has, and how truly intractable is it at the end of the day?
Thank you very much indeed. Cathy, perhaps I could ask you to just, if there's one message you want everyone to walk out of this room with, what is that message?
Get going. this is happening, this is coming. Please get on the job if you're not already looking at this and use us. What can we help you with? What are the things that might be issues? What solutions could we help facilitate? Who do you need to talk to? Do you need to talk to an Andrew? Can we help facilitate that sort of interaction? Let us know. And the other one thing is, when you're talking about Australian interest rates, just so you know, including the overnight index rate, the European Commission has issued a draft determination that looks like they'll give equivalence to our regulatory regime under the EU benchmark regime, which is a great story for us. I think it's for the Australian rate and the Singaporean rates. So we have a great deal of confidence in using the rates that operate here in Australia.
Thank you very much indeed to all of our panellists. Thank you.